Hello, and welcome to the Climate Diplomacy Podcast, a podcast from Adelphi bringing you the latest insights and debates in international climate diplomacy. I am your host, Raquel Munayer, Climate Diplomacy Analyst at Adelphi. In this series, you will hear from leading experts offering their take on what needs to be done to promote climate foreign policy and provide you with the context you need to understand climate diplomacy today. For more information, please visit our website, climate-diplomacy.org, or follow us on Twitter under Climate Diplo. In this episode, you will hear about the implications of unanticipated climate change on global efforts to resolve conflict and promote peace. Why does climate change matter to peacebuilding? Do we need to rewrite the rules of peacekeeping and mediation? Or are there smaller steps that can be taken to ensure the peace we seek to build can be sustained in a changing climate? In September, at the Berlin Climate and Security Conference 2020, Andrew Gilmore, executive director of the Birkhoff Foundation, renowned mediator and former diplomat Günter Bechler, and Janani Vivekananda, head of program at Adelphi, came together to discuss why and how climate change and environmental considerations have to be an integral part of conflict analysis and peacebuilding processes. Their experience, seeing firsthand the effects of climate change on conflict dynamics around the world, allowed for an interesting discussion about the need to change how peacebuilding is done in context of rapid climate change. Here's what Janani, Günter, and Andrew have to say about climate-related security risks in peacebuilding and mediation.
Changing climate, changing conflict. Welcome to this conversation here for half an hour on a very urgent topic. I'm Günter Bechler. I'm going to moderate this round together with Janani Vivekananda, head of program with Adelphi Research in Berlin, and Andrew Gilmore, director of Birkhoff Foundation on Conflict Transformation, also in Berlin. Climate change and the impact of climate change, of course, is different in various regions of the world. It's a global issue, it's a global challenge, but it has local and regional impacts. In the last decade or so, we were discussing these impacts, you know, on societies, on the environment, on natural resources, and we were discussing all kinds of issues related to those impacts. The assumption is that it could be a security problem, but at the same time, it could be at the core of ongoing and maybe future conflicts. I think we have to be aware that this climate change and this kind of negative impacts on societies and states and nations and the global society is a phenomenon that is affecting us today. It's not a future threat, so we have to discuss the challenge today, and that's our conversation. How do you see it, Janani? Is it a threat multiplier, or how would you see that phenomenon?
Thanks, Günter. So when I started working on this issue back in 2005, that climate change was a threat multiplier, was the then nascent, and I guess now it's the prevailing narrative, and it had its uses back then. I think it was serving this purpose of trying to move climate change from its little corner of political insignificance into the center, into the mainstream of, you know, core foreign policy, making it a national and international security issue. And I'd say it was pretty effective in doing that. It uses security framing, often delivered by military professionals, by three-star military generals, to try to convince climate skeptics, often those on the right, by linking climate change to the security implications, something that they care about, to ultimately push for greater climate commitments at the next big climate change conference that was then pushing towards the big climate summit in Copenhagen. But that was then, and this is now. And I think now we really need to move beyond this narrative of threats, looking at climate change as simply being about threats, about focusing on tipping points and mapping hotspots of where climate change pushes us towards violent conflict in certain parts of the world, and actually focus more on trying to understand the relationship between climate change, peace and security, so that we can really focus on what to do about this. I mean, yes, climate change is a threat multiplier. Yes, it does compound risks. But my problem with this narrative, with this framing, has always been, well, so what? What do we do about it? And I think that's the challenge. We don't have the answers to this question of what do we need to do differently? What do we need to change to be able to address these risks? preferably preventatively. So I think a more helpful way of thinking about climate change and its implications on this security landscape is to see it as something that inhibits peace. It's a peace inhibitor. It's part of every conflict context. It's something that, I mean, I don't think anyone now this year more than ever will doubt that climate change affects all of us, and therefore it affects every conflict context. And so if that's the case, what do we need to do? How do we understand these interactions? And what does that mean for peace? So if we accept that climate change is part of the context, it's part of every conflict context. It might not be the core driver of conflict, but it's part of every conflict story, and therefore it needs to be part of every conflict response. And I think that's why it's really important to shift the narrative now, to move beyond seeing climate change as simply a threat multiplier, to understanding the relationship between climate change and these different dimensions that stand in the way of peace, things like inequality, weak governance, a lack of basic service provision, and use this understanding to then inform appropriate responses that can help us transform conflict and work towards building peace which can withstand the changing climate that we're in now.
Climate change has an impact on the narrative, on the history also of conflicts. It is a core contributor. So let's look at this a little bit more in detail. This is a question actually to both of you. I start with Andrew. So in which way exactly and to what extent we can say today that climate change and the impacts on our societies is really kind of contributor or a cause of conflict or a factor of armed or violent conflict?
Well, thank you very much. I mean, for me, climate change is the defining development of our age. It's going to be even more for the age to come. But of course, if that's the case, which I think it is, then it also has a major impact on conflict. And we have had some progress in getting recognition on this. I mean, I remember in 2007, I was in the office of the UN Secretary General, the new one at the time, Ban Ki-moon. And I remember it was at the height of the genocide in Darfur committed by the Janjaweed against communities living there. And he made the point, perfectly reasonable and fully right point, that climate change was a contributory cause to the violence because of the pressures on land. But I do remember the outrage with which that remark was greeted. It was seen as somehow he was exonerating those carrying out the genocide and the mass atrocities. He was seen as a sympathizer of the Janjaweed and the Sudanese government because people didn't understand. They just wanted to blame the perpetrators, not to think that there could be any bigger cause or even a contributory cause. So as Janani said, and I totally agree with her, I think there's no conflict in the world that you could say it is primarily caused by climate change. But equally, there is no conflict in the world where climate doesn't play some sort of role. I also served 2 years in Iraq during the war, which happened to be the time of a particularly rough drought that covered both Iraq and Syria. What happened next should be attributed mainly to the catastrophic governance failures of both Baghdad and Damascus. But I think it is absolutely undeniable that the terrible drought and the infernal heat in Iraq and Syria during those years, 2007 to 2010, was a cause, at the same time as making the land completely infertile for hundreds of thousands of farmers and their family, but it made society very fertile for radicalization. And one can see fairly similar developments in West Africa, and Janani's organization at Delphi has done a lot of work on the Lake Chad Basin there, and we've done work on East Africa, Somalia, and the two Sudans and Ethiopia. I think it is no coincidence that in areas where you have the most extreme radical organizations carrying out terrible acts of violence and leading to great conflict are, for example, you would find Al-Qaeda in the Yemen, you would find the Islamic State in Syria and Iraq, you find Boko Haram in the Lake Chad Basin and Al-Shabaab in Somalia. These are four parts of the world that have had dramatic, far worse than other parts of the world, have had effects of climate change. The link for me is very, very clear, but as Janani says, it's not enough to establish the link. It is what do we do next to do about it. So for me, it is very clear that there is a strong link.
Janani, yeah. Is it also clear to you, and maybe you also have some examples from your research experience?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, yes, it's clear in that it's so complex and multidimensional, and I think those examples from you, Andrew, are brilliant. And I think what I'd like to stress is that it is about understanding the sometimes very subtle implications. So it's not just about looking for where there's an extreme climate shock and that pushes people into violence and then sparks begin to fly. And there you go, there's your link between climate change and conflict. It's often about how climate change puts a strain in very imperceptible ways on existing coping capacities and overwhelms them. When I've looked at this over the past 15 years across five different continents, I think, yes, there are numerous different pathways, and I can bore you all with outlining all the different pathways and the different mediating factors that can determine whether actually it escalates into violence or not. And every context is completely specific to the particular dynamics at play there. But across all of these contexts, there are two commonalities that I've come across. And one is that climate change stresses social cohesion. When climate change impacts affects people's access to or the availability of natural resources that they rely on, water, land, arable land, timber, etc., or their ability to pursue their livelihoods or food security, this puts a strain on relations between and within groups, between and across generations, between the young and the old, genders, between state and citizens. And this is especially the case in predominantly agrarian economies where governance is already weak and where there's been a history of conflict or there's already some level of conflict at play. And where that social cohesion, this kind of glue that holds society together when things get a bit tough, is being eroded, then there's a greater risk of conflict or conflicts coming up which can't be dealt with in non-violent ways because those non-violent pathways have been eroded. The other is around the social contract. Climate change puts pressure on the social contract, the relationship between citizens and the state. And this is especially the case in parts of the world where there's already weak governance structures, weak institutions. And so I'd say these are some very strong mediating factors. And in the face of all this complexity, this uncertainty, we don't always know exactly how climate change risks will play out in a particular context. And that does make prevention and response quite difficult. But I would say responses to these climate security risks, these new challenges that are part of the conflict landscape, would do well to not focus on the hazard, not try to think about what the specific risks are linked to climate change and build resilience to those risks. You know, there might be extreme heat, there might be floods. Do we respond to those and prevent that risk? Or no, I would say that the responses that would do best in the face of this uncertainty would be those that build resilience to this kind of coping capacity to help communities and societies deal with the range of climate shocks that they're likely to face. And that means focusing on building this societal glue, rebuilding that, and to focus on governance. And very often there are things that are missing in the way responses to these climate security risks are conceptualized. But in my experience, these are the two factors that really seem to underpin societal resilience to the climate security risks that they're facing.
It's really quite interesting. We have seen all the examples of Andrew, Janani, and it is an issue. The question then is, if this is so evident and so clear, a major factor throughout the world, why is it so difficult still to address this, to convince people that we have to work on it and we have to develop strategies, coping mechanisms, etc.? So what is your assumption? Why is it so hard to...
It is very hard. And I think there are a number of reasons for this. Let us take the widest angle you would have at the UN Security Council, which is the supreme body dealing with international peace and security and threats to it. There you have, let us be very frank, you have the most powerful country run by a climate change denier who says it's a hoax. His ambassador at the UN is the wife of a coal mining billionaire. And Russia is, let us put it, not too fine a point, not very strong on climate change. And China, though, which is, so understand the issue much better, is still reluctant to have it there because it believes that if you bring climate change to matters of peace and security, then the next thing you do will bring human rights. And that is what it is completely opposed to do. And then there are other global leaders of Brazil or Australia, of important countries, that just deny that there is even an issue of climate change being a problem. So that is the first issue, how to get the big players of the international system to fully get behind this matter. Secondly, the international system works in silos, in separate compartments, and it's still doing that. I mean, there are people who work on peace and security, those who work on development, those who work on human rights, and those who work on the environment. And there's far too little cross-fertilization between those. Development is probably quite well linked to the other three, but both human rights and the other fields find it very hard to work together. And then I think perhaps the third reason is that those people involved in peace building are finding it's a new issue. And they already have so many other factors that they need to mainstream, whether it's human rights or gender or security sector reform or justice or democracy. And this is just one more rather complex matter, complicating what is already a very, very full field of issues to be dealing with. And the last point, perhaps, is that people see it as tomorrow's problem. And I think we obviously all agree, but not everybody does agree, that it is today's problem. And it's going to be even worse tomorrow if we don't address it today. But the temptation for people dealing with conflict is to say, well, let's just settle the conflict first, then we can get on to sort of luxuries like climate change. And that mindset has to change.
You work for an organization that has been involved in this kind of integration of climate issues, environmental change, and conflict for many years now. How would you define coping mechanism or how to build resilience? What is your vision on that field?
So, like I said, there is so much uncertainty at play, and the climate projections that we have to work with are very variable. There are different models that tell us different things. There are some areas of the world, maybe the Sahel, where we've got a better understanding than others. But I think the crucial thing is that we need to be able to deal with uncertainty. And that does mean we need better governance structures. We need better sources of information to be able to make better risk-informed decisions. So I think in the face of all of this uncertainty, we need to build in resilience to our systems. I think it's important when we're talking about fragile contexts where any interventions, particularly those from the outside, can do as much harm as good if they're seen to be not helpful to a particular community. That means that the risks of getting it wrong, even with the best of intentions, the risks of getting it wrong can be very, very detrimental to peace, to the conflict dynamics. I remember I was doing some work in Nepal and there was a big climate change impact project to help that part of central Nepal deal with floods. So communities, it was very conflict sensitive. People were being brought in from the local communities to build a flood defense. And it was a big multinational bank project. And they were completely baffled. They were thinking, you know, this project is never ending. We're doing everything right. We're working with local community members, giving them livelihoods, part of this climate change project. They're meant to be building this flood defense, but it's never finishing. You know, they're working all day and then it's still not making progress. And it turned out that it was just not responding to people's climate needs or the perceptions of their climate needs, because whilst the climate models that the bank was using were predicting long-term flooding, increase in flooding, these people were in the midst of a three-year drought. And so they were so frustrated, they were so angry that they were building it during the day, yet they were all getting a daily wage for it, and then they would come back in the evening and unbuild. It just showed that the risks of getting it wrong can actually really do harm to people's trust in the government, trust in the institutions, and that in terms of building sustainable peace is quite harmful. So I think the best case, the kind of no regrets policies for many of the contexts that we're looking at will be to build institutional capacity, build lines of communication between the kind of knowledge providers and the communities that need it, between the water management commissions and the farmers that need to access the water, give people good weather forecasting information, give them access to news, give them market price data so farmers know when to sell their crops at market, etc. These aren't climate security measures. They're not even climate change measures. They're just kind of good sustainable development measures.
Yeah, it seems that these impacts, you know, they are kind of very complex or has a multitude of effects on societies. The question is now what to do and how to react. From our perspective, we see it as an impact on conflicts, changing conflict patterns, occurrence of conflicts around the world. So it can be catastrophic at the end of the day. From your organizational standpoint, Berkhof Foundation, but also at ELFI Research, what are next steps? What has to be done? Where are the priorities?
Thank you. You mentioned us, Berkhof and Adelphi, in the same breath, and I think rightly, because this meeting is an example of what has to be done at one level. We have to break down the walls of the separate disciplines of climate change or peace building and work together. So that in itself is something, and this is just one step. There can be many other elements and other disciplines that we need to bring into this debate and which we are planning to do together. Then we need to recognize that, as the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights said just last year, Michelle Bachelet, that climate change represents the biggest threat of all time to human rights. It sounds like hyperbole, but it isn't. And it's not just about the economic, social, and cultural rights, like the rights to livelihood, the rights to housing and health that are so damaged. It'll be some of the civil and political rights as governments take emergency measures, which always repress the rights of individuals. We need to educate people. And one thing we're doing at Berkhof, we've always done actually for nearly 50 years, is peace education. But we need to link that to climate change education and human rights education, and to see them all together because they are so closely related. Thirdly, what we have to do, again working together, is to have a conflict lens when you consider climate change, but also a climate lens when you're discussing conflict. So by doing that, you can come up with an assessment of conflict in the past, the present, and the potential impact of climate change on conflict, and trying to set up some early warning mechanisms at ground level to see what can be done among the communities to combat some of this. We need to, and Barkov has just started to do this, but only just, to start bringing climate change into the trainings and the workshops that we do of communities affected by conflict, and also some of the combatants as well. So we need to bring them into the various trainings and workshops and to understand the impact of climate change. And then lastly, and this is in some ways the most important one, it is when you get near a peace agreement and when you're sort of designing or negotiating a peace agreement, to bring in the various aspects of a green economy that could actually lead to a peace dividend. For example, both parties might see that it is very much in their interests of both sides to have a joint management of forests, for example, and land regeneration, or indeed building of renewable energy infrastructure. But, and this is a great problem, and what we have to try and resolve, is that mediators can't instruct investors. And you need to have a way whereby the World Bank and other financial instruments come in behind the mediation to ensure that the parties who want to resolve their conflict are able to do so and are supported financially if they're going to do so in a way that promotes a green approach that helps mitigate the impact of climate change.
Actually, it's interesting. When I helped to negotiate the Darfur peace agreement in Doha, we had a whole chapter on environmental change and resource management as part of the peace agreement, which should then translate into a new constitution and legislation and ordinances, etc. Should be a political program related to that.
But it was great that you were involved, because the Darfur agreement is only one of five peace agreements since the 90s, or since 1990, that actually mentioned climate change explicitly.
Actually, in Nepal, it was not really part of this comprehensive peace accord, also we insisted at that time, but it's not really there. So how would you address it now from your organizational background?
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree with the points you make, Andrew. I think where we are as a community is that we've kind of moved beyond a general acceptance that, well, yeah, maybe there is some relationship between climate change and security. I think when I started in this, I started in the peace building sector and I was met with this wall of resistance. We've got enough to mainstream. It's not our jam. Just comes later. There's a linear path, apparently, for conflict, and climate change comes right at the end of it. At the end, once peace has been established, of course, we know that conflict is a cycle, and there are entry points for addressing climate change at every single part of the conflict cycle, because climate change affects every part of the conflict cycle. But I think there is an openness to respond to this. Okay, we get it, we accept it, what do we do about it? And I think when it comes to answering that question, I think it's really important that we look at the conflict cycle and we understand where those entry points are. I think there are some really important entry points at the pre-conflict stage, and this is where you can do the most good. You can understand how climate change interacts with some of these drivers of grievances, of fragility, and get in there and address those before they escalate. And this means we need really good conflict analysis. We need to integrate climate security assessments into conflict analysis, make this normal, just like we do gender analysis, so that we can identify these risks and build them into kind of conflict prevention strategies. Once there is conflict in the escalation and in the kind of stabilization and peacekeeping phases, it's also incredibly important to see the relevance of climate change. It's not something that comes later. If you are trying to stabilize a context, you've got to deal with ex-combatants coming back and you need to reintegrate them, you need to give them livelihoods. I mean, the number of times we come across reintegration programs where ex-combatants in, you know, sub-Saharan African contexts are given agrarian livelihoods which are not sustainable in the face of climate change. They're given tools, they're given training to become fishermen or farmers, and this is a context in which fishing and farming or pastoralism or raising livestock is just no longer an option. And one thing I think anyone that works in conflict knows is that one thing that's more harmful than an angry young man is an angry young man whose expectations have been raised and whose expectations have then just not been met. And that's what you'll get if you give somebody a livelihood or give them new skills and they're not climate proof. So there are lots of spaces in the stabilization and post-conflict processes, and then also into the peace building and state building, because so much is about that social cohesion and institutional space. I think in very concrete ways, there is some climate language in peace agreements, but I think there's a lot more scope for this. There's also opportunities around mediation to not just include climate security risks in mediation processes, but also see some of these climate spaces as opportunities for mediation, because very often these are kind of neutral or kind of apolitical spaces where, maybe at least at the local level where I've mainly engaged, where you can get community members together to talk, maybe from warring groups, to actually come together to discuss how they cope with drought, because this is a common threat. Also include climate security risks in the mandates of all peacekeeping missions. I think there's language at the moment in about 7 peacekeeping missions, which is good, but the reality is that the words are there, but there's very little actual change in operations on the ground. So I think there really needs to be the capacity to actually do things differently, and that means a shift in mindsets as well. Not just the knowledge and capacity, but there is an incentive. And I think that the final thing here is that incentive, I think, needs to come from the very top. I think in a kind of peace building or climate security operational context, this means funding streams need to look for or call for climate security risks to be integrated into programming. At the moment, there's no incentives, there's no enabling environment, because you're not being asked to address climate security risks. And if you're not asked, you don't do it. If there is an incentive, if every donor says, just like you do with gender, we want to see that your programming does no harm to climate security risks, it's cognizant of the implications of this program, whether or not it's anything to do with climate change, it does no harm to communities' resilience to be able to cope with climate risks, and actually goes beyond that to actually do some good, to actively build resilience to these climate security risks, then I think we have a real hope of moving in the right direction.
So you have seen there are a lot of ideas, a lot has to be done, then I think we have to be more focused on all these issues in joint programs, in collaboration among institutions like yours, and also, of course, governments and states. You say it has to come from the top. I think I agree. The problem is, as Andrew mentioned, if the top level is not really aware or even denying the problem, I think we still have to do a lot of work.
Yeah,
I think you would agree.
Really. Yeah, absolutely, yes.
So please follow the discussion also on Twitter, hashtag BCSC2020. And thank you so much for this discussion. I think we addressed a lot of things. Now we have to deepen it to make concrete steps forward in our collaboration. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
It seems clear that peace builders need to understand the relationship between climate change and the different dimensions that stand in the way of peace. But the problem with the framing of climate change as a threat multiplier has always been that it doesn't actually tell us what to do about the challenge. Perhaps a more helpful framing is to see climate change as a peace inhibitor, as a core part of the conflict contest, and thus as a necessary part of any conflict response. When it comes to how exactly climate change affects peace, we heard how climate change stresses social cohesion, the impacts of climate on natural resources and weather-dependent livelihoods and on food security, strain relationships between and within different communities, within and across generations, genders, between citizens and the state. This is especially true in predominantly agrarian economies where governance is weak. We also heard examples of how climate change impacts weaken the social contract between state and citizens and can lead to unrest and conflicts, especially when this relationship is already strained. According to Andrew and Janani, considering climate change impacts on peace and security is a fundamental component of peace building, and since it is part of all conflict contexts, it can and should be included in every part of the peacebuilding process. Intervention spaces vary from context to context, but some examples would involve raising awareness of new risks in conflict analysis through climate security assessments and including climate security into existing reporting mechanisms, focusing on preventative action by responding to underlying drivers of climate security risks through sustainable development, ensuring climate and conflict sensitivity in all peacekeeping missions and adding climate security risks to their mandates, and last but certainly not least, including climate impacts on security in mediation and peace negotiations, as well as using climate impacts as an entry point for mediation and cooperation where appropriate. Janani and Andrew made it clear that to achieve this collaboration and partnerships between organizations is key, and a shift in financing is necessary. Thank you to our experts for giving us their insights on the importance of climate-related security risks in peacebuilding and mediation, and I wish Adelphi and the Berghoff Foundation all the best with their cooperation. You can reach us with questions and feedback in our Twitter channel under Climate Diplo. Thank you for tuning in, and until next time, goodbye.